Hello again, Trippers. Alex Zane here, film journalist, movie fan, and your host for another glorious episode of A Trip to the Movies. Thanks for joining me today. I am currently in our podcast studio a mile beneath the streets of London, and in a moment, my guest this week, Mr. Jeff Wadlow, takes us all on his perfect trip to the movies. Thanks for downloading the podcast. This episode is brought to you by Odeon, because if you're going to watch a movie, it has to be at an Odeon Luxe. For me, there is no better place to experience the mesmerizing magic of the big screen. And when I say big, I mean crystal clear, four times sharper, larger than life, I sense big. A place where you can recline in luxury whilst sipping on your favorite tipple as you immerse yourself in the all-consuming power of the story, enriched by epic Dolby Atmos that'll make your spine tingle and the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. Now that is how to experience a movie, and there's no better feeling. You can book your Odeon Luxe experience at odeon.co.uk or via the My Odeon app. Odeon say, we make movies better, and they're not wrong. Also, if you'd like to watch today's interview in glorious Technicolor, do head over to our YouTube channel where the video goes up a few days after the pod. And for all the latest updates and to get in touch, you will find us at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod on all social media. Right then, if you're ready, let's do this. Hello and welcome to the show where each week a special guest takes us on their perfect trip to the movies. This week we're joined by an excellent filmmaker who first landed on my radar when he wrote and directed superhero sequel Kick-Ass 2. Since then, he has brought the scares in the Blumhouse horror hits Truth or Dare and Fantasy Island, penned the Vin Diesel comic book adaptation Bloodshot, and now returns with more monstrous fun in the latest Blumhouse Fright Fest, Imaginary, which sees a childhood imaginary friend reappear in the guise of a terrifying teddy bear called Chauncey, which has murder on its mind. Here to tell us about that film and take us on his perfect trip to the movies, it's the wonderful Jeff Wadlow. Jeff, wonderful to have you on A Trip to the Movies. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing very well. I'm very excited to go to the movies with you, Alex. I'm a big fan of the podcast and thrilled to be here and thrilled to talk about Imaginary with you.
Oh, thank you. Well, listen, I can't wait to have you take us on the trip to the movies, but let's talk Imaginary. And I want to start with, because it only aired a couple of days ago as we're recording this, the absolutely immaculate Super Bowl spot that you guys cooked up. What a crazy coincidence, and how fortuitous to have another Imaginary Friend movie, but a family movie coming out at the same time.
Yeah, you know, sometimes there are these things that are just in the zeitgeist. If you look at the history of filmmaking, there was Volcano and Dante's Peak, obviously Outbreak, and it didn't get made, but Hot Zone was a big Hollywood movie that's supposed to get made at the same time. I'm sure there's many other famous examples of films about something similar coming out at the same time. I'm not sure that two films about the same thing with such contrasting tones have ever come out. So we might be the first in that department, but it is, listen, I'm a huge John Krasinski fan, a huge Ryan Reynolds fan. I can't wait to see their movie. I hope a rising tide raises all ships.
Yeah. Yeah, although the trailer, it was beautiful, just because I didn't get the Super Bowl here, but I'm imagining they aired very close to one another as well, which must have been just a mind fuck for some people watching going, what's John Krasinski done? Why is there a killer bear?
Yeah, well, you know, they didn't put it on during the Super Bowl. It was more of like an online response to their Super Bowl ad. Don't forget, there's a little bit of a David and Goliath thing going on here. Like, they are a much bigger movie with a lot more money behind their marketing. We're a little smaller, a little scrappier. We are a Blumhouse title. So there were no Super Bowl spots bought for this one. But it was fun to put something online responding to theirs.
I want to talk about, I think it's your second move with Blumhouse in a moment. But look, for those who don't know what Imaginary is, haven't seen the trailers, give me the elevator pitch for this movie. What are we talking about here with your film?
We're basically talking about an imaginary friend who was forgotten and wants revenge. That's really the elevator pitch. Of course, I love filmmaking that is an active experience. It engages the audience, that forces them to ask questions about the subjective experience of watching a movie. So it shouldn't be a surprise when I tell you that there's a lot more going on than just that.
I can believe that. And I love the trailers that I've seen, because it's a little soupçon of an idea about what this film is about. But Chauncey gets a mention. Let's just start with the name. Chauncey, this is already a scary name. Like, how many names did you workshop before you settled on Chauncey, which I kind of feel is going to be one of those names that resonates through time?
Well, if we're going to talk about the little guy, I have to bring him on camera. I don't want him getting mad at me. This is actually the bear that's in the movie. Again, because it's a Blumhouse production, we don't have a lot of money for a lot of bears. So we made four bears. We made a bear that could be puppeteered with rods. We had two floppy bears for Piper to carry around, so it looked like a real teddy bear. But anytime the bear sort of has agency and is sitting there looking ominously at our characters, this was the bear. And I've got him now.
That's amazing. You've got him. Yeah. I mean, well, nice to meet you, Chauncey. I can't wait to see your work on screen. Tell me this, though. I think you've previously described filmmaking as very much one of the most collaborative, if not the most collaborative, forms of art. So how much did you enjoy working with, I guess, your prop team, your effects team, in designing this? Because everyone, I guess, is looking for that new iconic horror icon.
Yes, and I haven't forgotten your question about the name too. I'll try to answer that as well. The name came from, honestly, my co-writers, Greg and Jason. You know, I've known Greg for over 20 years. We lived in the same apartment complex when we were in our early 20s, and we'd moved to LA to pursue our dreams of filmmaking. We were on a flag football league together, and it just always stayed in touch. So when I started working with Jason Blum and I got my overall deal with him, I wanted to come up with some new ideas to keep making movies for Blumhouse. Mm-hmm. And so I was reaching out to friends and other writers, and Greg and Jason came in, and we just started spitballing. And I said I always wanted to make a movie about an imaginary friend. They said they wanted to make a movie about an evil teddy bear that they wanted to call Chauncey. And so Chauncey comes from them. And honestly, I've never asked them further, like, where that came from, for further explanation, I should say. Because it was just so perfect. Sometimes when something hits you and you know it's perfect, you don't need to know more. And back to your second question, that's why I love filmmaking, why I love collaborating with other artists, you know, whether it's a prop maker, a creature designer, another screenwriter, you know, they're all contributing to the stew. And when they contribute something that just feels right, that's enough. Like, I don't need to know more. I like to kind of be a member of the audience sometimes in that sense. And when I heard the name Chauncey, I was like, yes, that is his name. It's perfect.
It's a great name. It's a great name. It's going to give a lot of kids nightmares in the future. Parents are going to be like, listen, go to bed or Chauncey's going to come for you. I can hear it now. I can hear it. You mentioned being part of the audience and sort of enjoying filmmaking in that sense. I think, you know, to take that to the next level, you've described this movie as a full-on theatrical experience, which obviously, you know, making this podcast and being a fan of cinema and going to the cinema, I love that statement. Tell mm-hmm. me what you meant by that statement. Why is this a full-on theatrical experience?
Because it should be immersive. You should experience it in the dark. It's scary. It's fun. It's funny. Mm. And I think to enjoy all those aspects of the film we've made, you want to be with a group of people. You want it to be a communal experience. And there's just something so primal about that. You know, long before the internet, long before movies or TV, we used to gather in groups around the campfire. And it's cliche, but it's true. And that's what going to the theaters is. That's the modern equivalent of gathering around the campfire. And this is just a fun, scary story that I think is smart and emotional about characters that people are going to connect to, and they should experience it in the largest format possible with a group of people.
Piper Braun, Alice in the movie, a young actress who plays the kid who befriends Chauncey, I'm always interested in this because obviously she's fairly young as an actress, and you're making a horror movie here. So how much do you make her aware of the context of what she's shooting? Or as a filmmaker, are you in some way having to protect her from the scare factor of a scene she's making?
Well, there's two things you should know right off the bat. I don't care how scary a movie is, the final version. When you're making it, it's hilarious. Like, it's very funny making a horror movie. Like, the whole concept of it is hilarious. You know, monsters, blood. I mean, as soon as you say cut and people, like, the monster is standing there like this and the blood is sticky and smells like sugar. I mean, it's just funny making a horror movie. So it's not like we need to really protect her from any psychological trauma. It's so obviously make-believe. Like, I'm sure we're going to traumatize kids who see the movie infinitely more than any actress of a young age who might be in a movie like this. But the second thing I want to say in response to that question is that Piper Braun is far more sophisticated and involved than I am. So I was not worried about protecting her. She is one of the most savvy, mature, self-aware actresses I've ever worked with. No, she's going to be more than fine. In fact, I'll probably be asking her for a job one day.
and playing her stepmom in the movie. So I'll be completely honest, and this is just personal taste. I wasn't a huge fan of Jurassic World Dominion, but I did love DeWanda Wise's character in that film. I thought she was probably the best thing in it, this sort of rogue, like snappy, like illegal arms pilot. It was like a kind of a Han Solo transplanted into the Jurassic World universe. How was it working with her? How was it bringing her into the world of Imaginary?
Well, I felt the same way as you, Alex. I thought she was amazing in the film, a total badass, an action hero for a new generation. And at first I felt she was completely wrong for Imaginary for that reason. And DeWanda has talked about this, so I'm not really saying anything out of school. I at first was like, I'm not sure. And so when we had our initial meeting, even though I was a huge fan of her as an actress, I expressed my concern. And she said, oh no, Jeff, I'm done kicking ass. I want to play a character who is vulnerable, emotionally available, experiencing her past trauma in a very present way, and is not sure how to deal with it and is in conflict. And instantly I knew she was perfect for the film. The fact that she had that level of self-awareness and she could look at her body of work and understand what she had been putting out there up until this point. And she viewed this movie as a chance to do something different, to stretch and to grow. And I was really excited about being a part of that with her.
You obviously, you know your horror, Jeff. I mean, like, you, from your first debut feature, Cry Wolf, to now, like, horror is a big part of your CV. So when it comes to making a creepy toy movie, you know, from Chucky through Blumhouse's own Megan, you know, this is a well-trodden genre. So how much are you as the filmmaker trying to deliver what an audience, you know, an audience does want from this kind of movie to making sure Imaginary brings something new to the table?
You know, I think the key to filmmaking for the largest possible audience, and that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in stories that transcend age and gender and culture that anyone can listen to or see and have a great time. When you're talking about stories like that, movies like that, I find no matter the genre, whether it's horror or action or comedy, audiences want the same but different, right? They want to feel that it's familiar, but they want to be surprised. And that balance is so critical because if you go too far in one direction, like you go too far into the same, into the familiar, they're like, seen it before, don't care. If you go too far into the different, the surprise, they're like, well, that wasn't satisfying. I didn't like that. I didn't feel like that was a good movie when I walked out, which is interesting if you really think about it. that they were so surprised that it wasn't good because it's not satisfying. And so it's all about striking that balance. And when it comes to horror in particular, certainly this subgenre of the creepy doll, the creepy toy, there are tropes that you have to embrace. You have to hit certain marks so they feel like they're seeing a movie in that space and the filmmaker understands that space. But then at the same time, you better find ways to surprise them. You better find ways to change it up or they're going to get bored. And I think we worked really hard to do that. And I do believe that we've achieved it.
I mentioned Cry Wolf there, your first movie, which I think you won a film competition and got $1 million to make a movie.
I did, and it sounds like a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money.
But well, this leads on to my question, because that's $1 million for Cry Wolf, and then Truth or Dare. I mean, these are figures pulled from the internet, so feel free to correct me at any point if they're way off the mark. But you're looking at $3 million for Truth or Dare, which you know then went on to make close to $100 million. Here, you got a $13 million, according to the internet, budget to play with. So, like, for a filmmaker who's made horror for $1 million, horror for $3 million, is now making a horror of $13 million. Like, what does that give you on the ground? What are you able to do that you have never been able to do before?
Well, you also have to remember that the movie I made before Imaginary was for Netflix, and that was a horror comedy, and I had $60 million on that one. So, okay. I was definitely suffering a little bit of whiplash coming back into the world of Blumhouse, where they do keep their budgets under control. But what Jason does, and the reason why he is so brilliant, and I think the most important producer working in Hollywood right now, is that he gives his filmmakers creative control. So yes, you have a much smaller budget, but you get to do what you think is best. And that creative freedom is priceless. And so when you're talking about the budget for Imaginary, yes, was considerably more relative to Truth or Dare and certainly Cry Wolf. Where those funds go, honestly, is to the creative, because you don't have any of this like overhead that some of these big movies have. You're not paying huge salaries to actors or to other producers, or honestly, you don't even have a bond. Most movies have a bond, which is insurance, basically. Like we don't have a bond on a Blumhouse movie. And so all that money goes on the screen. And in Imaginary, we basically gave it to one company, Spectral Motion. It's run by Mike Elizalde. He founded the company. They do all the monsters for Guillermo del Toro, James Gunn. And I had met with Mike when I was in my early 30s for a project that never got made, but I needed his help designing some robots. And he was really generous with his time. And I said, listen, when I have a real budget, I'm coming to you. And that's what I did. So the budget for our creatures and our monsters and our special effects makeup in this movie was sizable, way bigger than it should have been for a $13 million movie. But because, it's a Blumhouse movie, I was able to devote all of those resources towards our practical creatures.
And practical being the key word there. And I don't know how much you want to say about some of the elements to this. And I realize that Chauncey's looking at me with those terrifying lopsided dead eyes, one higher than the other, which is the lack of symmetry. I get that, it's terrifying. So
yes, it is.
With that in mind, and with Chauncey's dead-eyed stare, how much do you want to talk about the bear beast?
The bear beast is in some of the marketing materials already, so I don't think it's a spoiler to say that Chauncey has more than one form, because ultimately he is a figment of the imagination. Whose imagination, why it's manifesting in this way? These are questions that I'm not going to answer right now because I want you guys to be surprised by the movie. But I will say that as a imaginary creature, he can take on many different forms, and not just the bear beast. There's other forms he can take on as well. But we did want a really terrifying, almost sort of primal feeling when you see him in this monster form that he takes on at one point in the movie. And Spectral Motion helped us create a practical version of that. And for me, the key to doing really scary monsters, and honestly, any kind of scary gag, is to do it practically, but augment it with VFX. So there are some filmmakers who are, only want to do practical, and it just starts to feel dated. Like modern savvy audiences can tell when it's just a guy in a rubber suit. But at the same time, a lot of filmmakers have embraced CG so wholeheartedly that it's not that scary because the thing on the screen has no weight. It doesn't feel like it's actually sitting in the space. So for me, what I found works the best is a hybrid approach where you have a practical version of the scare, of the monster, whatever it is you're trying to achieve. So the actors have something to react to, that it's interacting with the light and the space, that it feels grounded in the space, that the laws of physics are applied to it because it does exist in real life. But then you very carefully augment it to make it feel special, to make it feel like it's not something that exists in the everyday world, that it's not just a guy in a big furry suit. And that's exactly what we did with the bear beast. And so I don't really want to ruin all the magic, but it is a practical creature with VFX augmentation. And I think the end result is truly terrifying.
I cannot wait to see it in action. I'm very excited for Imaginary, Jeff. It hits cinema screens on March the 8th here in the UK. We're going to talk about more Imaginary trivia and information as we go on our journey. But Jeff, it's time to leave this reality and head to a dimension of pure film where our virtual cinema awaits. Jeff, you are our guide. We are your audience. Let's go on your perfect trip to the movies. So we push open the doors to our temple of film and find ourselves in the foyer. There's an excited buzz, as there always is in a cinema foyer. The hum of anticipation. It's your perfect cinema trip, Jeff. Who have you picked, living or dead, to go with?
I'm sure it's a cliche answer, but if I have to answer sincerely without trying to be funny, I would pick my mom. I saw the very first movie in a theater in my life with my mother. She took me to see Pinocchio when I was like, probably 3 or 4 years old. She passed away about 20 years ago. Nothing would make me happier than to see her again and go with her to the movies.
So I'm assuming then that your mom was a big part of your cinema education, your cinema literacy.
Absolutely. You know, in so many ways, not just in taking me to the movies, but also my love of art and culture. I definitely attribute to her. Two anecdotes I would offer about her that I think reflect how much she impacted my career. One was that when I was in the seventh grade and I knew I wanted to be a director, I'd known that since I was a little boy, but you know, I was living in a small town in Virginia and it wasn't really evident to me how I was going to get to become a filmmaker. She pulled me out of school for 2 days. And this was a big deal because she was a huge believer in education and we were not allowed in this school ever. But she took me out of school for 2 days and I got to go see a shot by shot workshop on Citizen Kane taught by Roger Ebert. There were about 30 of us in the audience. And each day we met with him for about 4 or 5 hours. And we spent 2 days going through the movie, watching it and pausing it and talking about the composition, the use of deep focus. He would tell anecdotes about Orson Welles. Like that, you know, that amazing shot where they push into the neon sign and the camera appears to travel through it. You know, he told us, well, that was a breakaway sign. That's how they achieved that. So all these little details that seem kind of obvious now. But for me as a 13-year-old, I was like, oh, my gosh, I didn't know you could make a breakaway sign. Like I started to understand the concept that everything off screen is malleable. That for you as a filmmaker, you can change things. You can manipulate everything outside that frame to create the effect you want on the screen. And so it changed me and also showed me that there was a path forward that involved studying film and sort of set me up for what I would do after high school. And the second anecdote I would share about my mom, and it sort of illustrates what a tremendous impact she had on my career as a filmmaker, is when I was finishing high school, I started looking at film programs and she was adamant that I actually go to a liberal arts school and get a broad-based liberal arts education. Because she said to me, and no disrespect to people who went straight to film school, but she said to me, do you want to be an artist or do you want to be a technician? And I said, well, I want to be an artist. And she said, if you want to be an artist, you need to understand the world you live in. And the best way to do that is to get a broad-based liberal arts education. And then afterwards, you can go to film school. And I'm so grateful that she gave me that advice because it really has informed almost every choice I've made in my career.
Fantastic. Right, Jeff, it's you and your mother going to the cinema. Now there is a clock on the wall in the foyer. It reads a specific time. What time of day are we going to the cinema?
You know, it's funny. for me, it depends on the genre. It depends on what kind of movie I'm seeing. If I'm seeing a scary movie, I don't want to see it during the daytime. I want to go and see it at night. Often if there's a big blockbuster coming out, I want to see it the day it opens. And I don't want to go see it at 7 o'clock at night because I'm probably not going to get a ticket because it's probably sold out. So I usually go for the earlier show so I have a chance at getting a good seat. But if I'm being genre agnostic, I would say there's nothing better than going and seeing a movie, you know, like 7:30 at night. You've had a chance to get a bite ahead of time. You, given how long movies have gotten, you don't risk, you know, falling asleep in the movie if there's any lulls, which happens. By the way, even for, I think, for the biggest film fans, you know, you see a movie when you're exhausted, there's going to be a low point in the narrative when you're going to nod off. And I hate that. I don't like doing that. I want to be fully focused on what I'm doing. So I would pick 7:30 at night.
Yeah. And that is obviously a busy screening. That's when most people do go and see the cinema, go to the cinema. So you like a busy auditorium then, I'm guessing.
Yes. Yes.
Let me then ask you, what was the first experience like for you watching Imaginary with an audience, let's say, who weren't involved closely with the film? So a cold audience. When was that? Where was that? And where was your head at when the title first appeared on the screen? How are you feeling in that moment?
Well, I'm going to give you two answers. The first answer is more of sort of a intellectual, academic one, which is, when I did study film, one of the things that I talked about a lot, in fact, I wrote my thesis on it, was that the final product in the filmmaking process is actually not the film. The final product is the meaning the audience makes when they perceive your story through the filter of their own experience. So when you embrace that idea, you're acknowledging that the audience is actually an active participant in what you're doing. It's not some like afterthought. So I love watching my movies with an audience, especially before they're completely done and I have a chance to still change them, because I'm basically saying, you guys are just as important as the actors, as the DP, as me. Like, the meaning that you make, the feelings that you create when you take our story and you push it through the filter of your own life, that is what I'm all about. That's what I'm after. So I'm desperate for that feedback. I don't understand filmmakers who don't like test screenings, because I think it's so critical to just feel what the audience is feeling in that moment so that you can make little changes and, you know, shorten a shot or lengthen a scene or spend a little more time with the character so that you're amplifying that end result. That being said, from a pure emotional standpoint, it's terrifying, and not terrifying in a good way, like a horror movie. It's terrifying because I give everything I have to every one of my projects. I'm a big believer that if you don't leave it all on the floor, then you've just done yourself and the movie a disservice. So I've invested every ounce of creative energy I have in this thing. And so I'm petrified that they're not going to like it, that they're going to laugh in the wrong places, that it's not going to land in the way I intended. I do cut myself a little bit of slack by acknowledging that it's not really what I want at the end of the day. It's what they want. That's the whole point of this. So I'm not too hard on myself if something doesn't land the right way, but I am utterly petrified. It's not dissimilar to, I don't know, like almost like a reverse blackout or something, like where you're stuck in your body and you're experiencing things, but you have no control over what's happening.
Yeah, I get you. I get you. Yeah. It sounds terrifying. I cannot even begin to imagine what it's like, but I do find it fascinating what you're saying about test screening, because I think you're right. There seems to be a stigma around them where there is this, and I believe it's a false idea now that test screenings are almost imposed by the studio and every director out there is rallying against them. No, I have my vision. And, you know, I was speaking to Christopher Nolan recently. I did an interview with him, and I'll admit, even I was surprised when he was like, no, we use test screenings for Oppenheimer because, you know, for exactly the reasons you've just outlined. You know, it's only half a movie until the audience go, we love this bit, we don't get that bit.
Yeah. I think it comes down to creative control, honestly. It's what we were talking about earlier, and that's why I love working with Jason. Of course, if I had a studio insisting on a test screening and they were going to interpret the results the way they wanted to, and they were going to change the movie based on what they felt after that test screening, I would hate test screenings too, you know, because it just becomes a bludgeon that an outside force is going to use to manipulate the story that you've been working so hard to tell. And I don't even say like my story. I don't really view filmmaking that way, but the story that we agreed to tell at the beginning, right? If some outside force is going to use a test screening as an instrument to manipulate the situation, yeah, I would hate it too. But what's great about Jason is that's not the way it works. We show the movie to an audience together. He's there. It's the first time he sees the movie. He doesn't watch cuts until the first test screening, which I think is fantastic because he's taking himself out of it. It's not about his ego. It's not about what he thinks is the producer. He sits there next to you, the filmmaker, the director. Well, I mean, he's the filmmaker too, but we sit there together and we experience the movie with the audience and you just feel it and you know what parts are working and what parts aren't working. And it's not that hard to reach a consensus pretty quickly when you come at it from a place of zero ego.
Yeah, you make an absolutely valid point there. I guess test screenings are fine as long as the control is then handed back to you to make the changes.
Yeah, and make them together. As long as you're all rowing in the same direction. And I'm sure on a Christopher Nolan movie, everyone is rowing in the same direction. and certainly what's great about working with Jason Blum is that he makes sure everyone is rowing in the same direction as his directors.
Right then. We're going at 7-ish in the evening, a busy screening. Okay, you booked the tickets for this trip. Thank you so much, Jeff. Where in the auditorium will we be sitting?
That's a fun question because most of my memories of going to the movies with my mother and growing up, there was no assigned seating. You know, it was first come, first serve, right? Like that's the way it always was, certainly here in the States. Only I'd say in the last like 10, maybe 20 years, have you found that most theaters have gone to assigned seating? I always want to sit right in the middle with the, you know, so that the screen just, you know, fills your whole field of vision, right? Not too close to the front, not too far in the back, right in the middle. That's where the surround speakers are going to hit you the best. That's where you can feel the audience around you. I mean, that's just the sweet spot. I absolutely love it. A lot of theaters now will have sort of walkways in the middle if they're stadium seating. And so if the front row of the second section isn't being held for, disabled audience members, those are great seats to get as well because you have leg room and you don't have to worry about someone super tall sitting in front of you. Because what I will do is someone very tall sits in front of me or someone like behind me or to my left or to my right is really loud and talking a lot before the movie begins, I have no qualms getting up and moving. Because I do not want to have my experience ruined. So I've definitely moved many times right before a movie has begun because I did not like the vibe around me.
I get that. And those seats that you've just outlined, that seat with a walkway in front of them, that is my dream seat for a very particular reason. This is due to me. You mentioned it earlier. Films are getting longer now. And it's, you know, I'm getting older. So there aren't that many movies these days where I am not going to need to go to the bathroom at some point during it. But those seats, I can sit in the middle, duck under the bar and get out so I don't have to even sit on an aisle because that is where I normally have to sit.
I call that the pee sprint because and I think about when I'm going to go. By the way, you should steal this question for your podcast. When would you want it? When do you think you would go to the bathroom in a movie? Because what I always try to do is like after there's been some big exposition scene where they've explained everything and you feel like you've gotten this information dump. That's when I act like I'm in a race, like the gun just got fired and it's ready, set, go. And I'm out of there. I'm sprinting to the bathroom to pee as fast as possible because there's usually some like sort of travel log or some moment of like, you know, no information. They're not going to jump right into a big action sequence. You usually have sort of a breath to sprint to the bathroom. And that's usually when I try to make the trip.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You've got the slow burn start of an action sequence. And by the time you get back to the theater, wham, there you go. And then the action really starts. I'm going to A, steal that question and B, try that myself. We are sitting right in the center. The most popular seats on the show. And the final thing we need, the air in the foyer is full of wonderful smells. All manner of snacks and foodstuffs are available at the various counters. What are you choosing to eat?
You know, it's a classic choice, but popcorn with butter is my jam. You know, if I'm feeling something sweet, I'll go caramel corn, but that's usually the most I'll deviate from the good old standby. Now, back to the test screenings. One thing that they do, which I think is really fun, is when you do these test screenings now, they give you like a VIP pass so that you can go to the concession counter and get whatever you want. The studio pays for it. So I'll go a little crazier at those test screens, mostly because I'm anxious and I'll just be eating my feelings. And then I'll like get a hot dog, the nachos, whatever. I'll try it all and feel pretty sick to my stomach afterwards. But when I'm going just by myself as a fan of films, nothing's better than like a big bag of popcorn with movie butter on it.
I love this. We don't have it in the UK. For whatever reason, this butter has not traveled the Atlantic, because I know the butter you mean, that's not really butter. It's in American theaters, not in UK theaters, but it doesn't look like butter, but it looks delicious.
I don't know what it is or what it's made of, but it is wonderful.
Right then, we have our big butter popcorn. We're leaving the foyer. We push open the door to the corridor down towards the auditorium. Now, the corridor's looking a little bare at the moment, so I'm going to put up some posters that illustrate some of your most important movie memories. And the first poster I'm going to put up, Jeff, is the poster for your fondest movie memory.
That's tough. As I mentioned, the first movie I saw was Pinocchio. That was a pretty important moment in my life. I remember it vividly, like it was yesterday, even though it was like probably only 4 or 3. That was with my mother. The first R-rated movie I saw was when I was 5 years old. My parents were divorced, and I don't think my father thought about the rating at the time. He took me and my older brother to see The Road Warrior, and that was just incredible. I will never forget the feeling of watching those chases and how adrenalized we all were coming out of the theater. I mean, I actually remember my father saying that, you know, he wanted to like smash his car into something or, drive as fast as he could. Like you just had this incredible visceral feeling from seeing that film. I mentioned Citizen Kane with Roger Ebert. Honestly, like recent experiences, Paranormal Activity with a sold out audience at the Cinerama Dome was just surreal and so much fun. I had no idea what the movie was really about. I don't know if you remember, but they did this weird viral campaign where you had to demand to see it and they just didn't give you much information ahead of time. But also, I'm such a huge James Cameron fan, and Aliens was my favorite movie growing up. I went and saw Titanic the day it opened in the first screening at 10 a.m. And this was really before everything was spoiled on the internet. So I just didn't know what to expect. And I was completely, utterly floored by that movie. I remember coming home and talking to my mom about it and saying, like, I've just seen the most amazing movie ever made.
Wow. Well, we'll talk more about Aliens, because there's a lot to talk about with Aliens. It's one of my favorite movies of all time, and it certainly was growing up, and it's my favorite Alien movie by some distance. We got a few options there. Road Warrior, Citizen Kane, Paranormal Activity, Titanic opening day. We've only got room for one. Is there one of those that stands above the rest that you'd like to put a poster up of?
You know what? I'm going to say Titanic. I mean, I think people have sort of different feelings about it in hindsight, given what a phenomenon it became, and you know the fact that it launched Leonardo DiCaprio's career, and the Celine Dion song is so associated with it now. But for me, going in knowing nothing other than my favorite director had made this movie and it was the most expensive movie ever made. it was just such a phenomenal experience. So that's the one I'm going to pick.
All right, then. We're putting up a poster for Titanic. Yeah, it's fascinating. The story about how I think he cast Leonardo DiCaprio in that, or convinced him, because Leonardo DiCaprio, I think he'd played quite troubled characters mainly till that point. And Jack is such an honest and lovely and wholesome character. And Leonardo DiCaprio didn't want to do it. And James Cameron had to basically go, no, look, this is actually a tougher role to play, to be this character, than play someone troubled. And once he framed it in that way, I think Leonardo DiCaprio was like, yeah, all right. Okay, I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's an incredible performance. And the movie, I remember having such survivor's guilt almost after seeing it. Like you felt like you'd been through this horrible tragedy and seen all these people die. It's mind-blowing, that film.
It is. It is right. Titanic. That's our first poster. We'll carry on down the corridor. It's time to put up our second poster. And this one depicts your worst movie memory.
Well, it's really no fault of the film, but I would say Tim Burton's Batman. And it's because it was 1989. For me, 1989 is like a really significant year. 1989 and 1999 are 2 years I always talk about in the context of when films were released and where I was in my life. 1989 was a really important year. I was 13 years old. I think I was sort of becoming I was becoming a young adult and thinking about the stories I wanted to tell and the movies that excited me. And I could not have been more excited for Tim Burton's Batman. I just was thrilled to see it on the big screen. You know, I'd read Entertainment. I would read Entertainment Weekly cover to cover. That was our only real source of entertainment information back then. And I'd read all these articles about it. And I was just so curious to see what Tim Burton was going to do with this iconic character. And we were on a family vacation in Wyoming. And there was a movie theater, a one screen movie theater that was showing it. And we're out there to, you know, enjoy the wilderness and the sun and the and nature. And I somehow convinced my family to go to the movies on vacation. And we went and saw Batman. And we were in the theater and the print got stuck. And you know that total cliche where the print gets stuck in the projector and you see the like celluloid kind of bubble and burn.
Yeah.
And then you get a white screen. That happened in the middle of the movie. And because it was a one screen theater, they had one print. And so they were like, sorry, we're going to refund your money. And I was like, what? I need to know what happens. I need to see the rest of this movie. It was devastating.
Wait, how far into you were it? Like, had Jack Napier become the Joker at that point?
So Nicholson had emerged. I think we'd gotten, my memory serves me correctly, I think we were in that moment when he's talking to Jack Palance and he's like, you know, he's kind of holding him by his arms. And he's like, I can't remember the exact line, but he's doing his Jack Palance before he kills him. I think we were in that scene when it happened and I was just so upset.
So Batman or Batman Returns, of the two Burton Batmans, do you have a favorite?
I mean, they're both great for different reasons. I mean, I like Batman Returns because, you know, Tim Burton really let his freak flag fly on that one. There are certain things I don't like about it. Like, I think he almost deviated a little bit too much from some of the canon. I mean, the canon is so rich and interesting. I don't think you need to deviate from it. But that was a different time. You know, that was a time when filmmakers would get properties and it was much more about keeping the aspects that they liked and reinventing the aspects they didn't like. Obviously that's all changed now. Now filmmakers really want to just like nail it and get it right so that the fans appreciate the screen translation. I think I would probably go with the first one just because of the Joker and Jack Nicholson and also because Burton didn't have the huge success of the first film under his belt. I think he was striving more to connect with the audience and get at that thing that I've been talking about, you know, the meaning that the audience makes when they see the film, as opposed to just what Tim Burton wanted to say with the film, if that makes sense.
I get exactly what you mean. Yeah, I mean, people often call Batman Returns like the Batman movie for people who don't like Batman, because yes. Burton just did Burton all over.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. I think for me as well, Batman, that 1989, that was the first blockbuster, and you're reading magazine articles and there's lunchboxes, t-shirts, and you're like, what is this?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what I was trying to say with it coming out in 1989 when I was 13. Like, of course I saw Return of the Jedi in theaters in 83 and I'd been going to see big movies in theaters, but I think Burton's film in 89, that was the first time I really felt the marketing machine behind this kind of cultural event that was going to be this blockbuster. And it was so exciting.
Right then, we're putting up a poster for Batman 1989 as your worst movie memory, but nothing to do with the quality of the movie. And the third poster we're putting up depicts the last performance, Jeff, that brought you to tears.
It's funny. I have no problem getting choked up, you know, in the movies. I love feeling things deeply when I'm seeing a film. Like, I remember seeing Hotel Rwanda and just being beside myself, just like, you know, tears running down my face. It was so intense and so moving. In fact, it wasn't just me, the person sitting next to me, I didn't even know, was crying so much that I actually like gave her some napkins that I had with my popcorn because she was, you know, couldn't contain herself. I was trying to think of the last time it happened. And it's not what you're going to expect. It was Avengers Endgame. And it was the moment when everyone comes back, spoilers, by the way, although I assume everyone on the planet has seen the movie by now. But that moment, you know, there's that image of Captain America standing with the broken shield and the hammer. It's a wide shot. It's very, it's a wonderful tableau. You know, he's on the left, Thanos is on the right. The forces of Thanos are behind him. And you just have this tremendous sense of all is lost. And, you know, Iron Man's down for the count, Thor's down for the count. And then you hear Sam, you hear Falcon on the headpiece saying on your left. And then the portals start to open. And it's so perfectly timed. Like the rhythm of it is so perfect. The way it like slowly builds. One portal opens and then you know another one. And then T'Challa comes through. And then you start seeing these other characters. And the music is very low and it starts to build. And you're cutting to Steve Rogers and you're seeing on his face, you're seeing his reaction. And then more characters are coming, more portals are opening. Suddenly everyone is there. Even, you know, Hulk and Ant-Man, who's now Giant Man, who you thought were buried, they're bursting out of the rubble. And everyone's there and the music is building. And you're doing that shot and you're swooping in and Iron Man lands right next to him and he grabs a hammer and he says, and he whispers, "Assemble," just as the music bottoms out. I mean, I teared up. It was like every fantasy I had as like this comic book collecting little nerd who wanted to make movies. It just like all happened right there, and all there's friends and family were there, and just in the craftsmanship of building it and then releasing it. It was surreal. Like I was just completely and totally emotionally overwhelmed.
I get it. Yeah, I mean. I'll be completely honest. I rewatched it today, and it's both the audacity, although not really, because the fandom is so strong. But the fact that you're doing a callback on your left is a callback to a movie from 6 years earlier, like yep. Winter Soldier was 6 years earlier, and that callback. Yeah. And I think it does something to all of us where we're like, I get that, and it works, and it's beautiful, and you just go.
Yeah, it's, you know, I have this theory that, you know, great songs you can listen to over and over and over again, and you have the same sort of pleasurable experience as listening to that song. 99.9% of movies don't work that way. Once you've seen it, you've seen it. And yeah, you can rewatch it and you can appreciate it and you might connect to it emotionally again, but it's never the same as the first viewing. There is this tiny fraction of films like The Wizard of Oz, The Godfather, Jaws. And by the way, it's not like a set list. Like people will have their own versions of this film for themselves. But there is a tiny fraction of films that you can watch again and again and again, like it's a song, and have that emotional experience the same way you had it the first time. And I think it has a lot to do with just rhythm, just the way a movie is cut, the way it hits certain beats, the way the music builds and releases. There's a musicality to the narrative and it can work you over emotionally the same way it did the very first time. And it's my goal. I don't know if I'll ever achieve this, but I would love to make a movie like that, that affects an audience in that way.
I think you're absolutely right. It is just a phenomenal, phenomenal piece of cinema. Let's put it up. Avengers Endgame is the last performance that brought you to tears. The portal scene and the final poster, Jeff, before we leave this corridor and get into the auditorium, is your unpopular movie opinion.
Yeah, and maybe this is just sort of betraying, you know, that I'm a child of the 80s, but I think Rocky IV is the best Rocky movie.
Okay.
Yeah, I know, I can tell you're flabbergasted by this response, Alex. Yeah, if you told me I could only watch one of the Rocky movies again for the rest of my life, that all the rest would be dead to me, and I had to pick one, I would pick Rocky IV.
Why? I mean, I'm assuming you've seen it since, and I know for sure you've seen Rocky like as an adult, but like, yeah. is it just nostalgia, or is there something else at play here?
It's back to that point I made on your last question about how certain movies can just create the same experience for you over and over again, like a song. And while there are certainly films that do that for everyone, like, you know, Star Wars or Jaws or Wizard of Oz, Rocky IV, I think, is specific to my upbringing. The fact that I watched most movies as a kid outside of the theater on HBO. And you just had to watch them when they were on. You know, we didn't, I rarely had the foresight to record them on the VCR. DVRs didn't exist. Certainly wasn't any streaming. And for some weird reason, Rocky IV was always on HBO, like always on. I think it was playing at least once a day for like all 4 years of my high school education. So I've just seen that movie so many times. And I think it has a rhythm that just affects you like a great song. And, you know, from Apollo Creed's death through, you know, the training, when you're seeing the different styles, you know, technology with Ivan Drago and sort of the back to basics training that, Rocky's doing. And then you go into this final fight and you can feel all the animosity and tension in the arena. But by the end of the fight, they're cheering for Rocky. It's just a really fun ride. It's emotional. It's exciting. It's visceral. It's funny. And to be honest, as great as the first movie is, and I'm sure this is cinema sacrilege, I don't really feel like it holds up. Like, I get a little bored when I watch it. You know, I can appreciate it as a cinephile, but it's just not that much fun to watch the first Rocky, whereas I still have fun watching Rocky IV.
I love it. I mean, look, you know, I wasn't going to say it earlier. I'm with you on this. You know, we can share this unpopular opinion. I love Rocky IV. I love the fact that Rocky solves the Cold War in a fight at the end. I mean, you know, he's gone global. He's gone global at this point. Right. Yeah. I'm putting up a poster for Rocky IV being the best Rocky movie as your unpopular movie opinion. All right, let's push open the final set of doors. We're in the auditorium now. So there's a few things I'm going to play on the big screen before we get to the movie you've picked to screen for us. And the first is a trailer for the movie you are most looking forward to seeing at the cinema.
Well, this should be no big surprise, given the last movie that brought me to tears. It's Deadpool 3. I cannot wait to see that movie. I was lucky enough to write an X-Force script for Fox before the original Deadpool film was made. He'd been in X-Men Origins Wolverine. And as a comic book fan, I knew that that was a travesty, that that was a total abomination. And I wanted to get it right. So I got a chance to write the X-Force movie. And my pitch for the movie was, if X-Men is about mutants who get to go to private school, what about the mutants who go to public school? What about the mutants who don't have a, you know, an X-Jet and Professor X and Wolverine swooping in to like show them the way and teach them? What about the mutants who got to figure it out on their own? And so I wrote this movie that was very much inspired by the original X-Force run back in the 90s. And I introduced Cable as a sort of dark mentor for characters, but it was definitely about, you know, the young mutants, who, you know, the formerly known as the New Mutants. But in my movie, it was Cannonball, it was Boom Boom. I aged Domino down and put her in the group, but Richter was there, Feral was there. And I put them on this sort of kind of road movie. I modeled the movie a little bit after Red Dawn, the movie from the 80s with, you know, Patrick Swayze. And they were doing these mutant internment camps that were sort of a analog for the Japanese internment camps that happened during World War II. But they were on the run in kind of West Texas, and that was the vibe of the film. But I wanted this antagonist chasing them the whole time. And as most people probably know, Deadpool was introduced as a villain in the original X-Force run, and so I had our main villain hire a mercenary to hunt this group of ragtag mutants down, and the mercenary hired was Deadpool. And I said, he's in like these motorcycle leathers with a red ballistic face mask. And I made it very clear that he was going to look just like he does in the comic book, but I was justifying all of the choices. But he's heavily scarred, and that he was the merc with a mouth. And I had so much fun writing the character. And I wanted Ryan to play the part. And I think the studio, after, you know, X-Men Origins Wolverine, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty about where the X properties were going, whether they were going to start over or where they were going to continue the story. But through my agency, I got in touch with Ryan and I got him the script, and he read it and he loved it. And he said, it's like this grand cameo for Deadpool. I mean, he's in a lot of the movie, but it's definitely a supporting part. He is a sort of a, almost like Tommy Lee Jones in The Fugitive, chasing these characters. And I played him as an antagonist. Well, ultimately they turn him in the end, but I just really loved writing the character. ultimately they didn't make the movie. They made the Deadpool solo movie instead. And I love that movie. I think Ryan is brilliant in the film. It's just a perfect pairing of actor and character. And he just nails the voice from the comics in the films. And so I'm just so excited to see Deadpool 3. I mean, and the fact that Hugh Jackman is in it as Wolverine, honestly, that's just gravy. I mean, obviously I'm excited about that too, but where Ryan takes Deadpool next is the movie I'm most excited about.
So have you watched the new trailer that just dropped a couple of days ago?
Hell yeah. Yes. Oh, absolutely. No, so exciting. It was so exciting. I mean, the fact that they're using the TVA. I love that they're taking that sort of post-credit sequence from Deadpool 2, which was, I think just a joke. But they're clearly, that's going to be the foundation of the third film now, which I think is so much fun. I cannot wait to see that film. Also, because it just has this all bets are off kind of energy, which is that surprise that I talked about. It's like audiences, you know, we want what's familiar. We want Ryan. We want Deadpool. But we also want that surprise. We want that feeling that all bets are off. And certainly that movie brings that to the table in spades.
Oh, I mean, bearing in mind your love of comics growing up, your work on Kick-Ass 2, this X-Force script, writing the Vin Diesel Bloodshot movie. Are you planning on returning to the superhero genre at some point in the future? Is that on the bucket list?
Absolutely. I would kill to make a big superhero movie. I've gotten very close on a few. You know, after Iron Man came out in 2008, I called up my manager. I was like, you got to get me in at Marvel. I don't know what they're doing next, but that movie, it was such a game changer. I want to go and pitch. And I thought at the time they would never in a million years make a Captain America movie. So I came up with the Captain America pitch and I went and pitched it to them. And I won't do the whole thing right now, but needless to say, I think my pitch was too far afield from their intentions, because part of my thesis was that Captain America shouldn't be a blonde white guy. That's like an Aryan ideal. Captain America should look like Will Smith or like this wrestler named The Rock. Ultimately, they obviously had different plans. But yes, 100%, I would kill to make a big superhero movie.
So we'll play the trailer for Deadpool 3 on the big screen as the movie you're most looking forward to seeing at the cinema. I was going to say the other movie, you were going to direct Ryan in another movie, weren't you? Was it the Hitman's Bodyguard?
Yeah, no, Ryan and I really hit it off, and he actually asked me to look at that script, and I loved it. And I cast Sam Jackson, I cast Salma Hayek. And unfortunately, just the way things work in Hollywood is schedules don't always line up. And Ryan had just finished Deadpool, and he wanted to take the time to focus on post on that. And I got involved in another movie with Netflix. And then when he was ready to do it, I was stuck in post on that movie. And so obviously, you know, they made it without me with my blessing, they used all my crew. I storyboarded all these action sequences. They ended up using all those. And I think the movie's a lot of fun. I thought Patrick did a great job. And I mean, look, everything Ryan does is great in my opinion. So, I wish I could have made it with him, but I thought the film was a ton of fun, and I'm really proud of what I contributed to it.
All right, then. The next thing we're going to play on the big screen is the movie moment that makes you literally or metaphorically pump your fist in the air.
You know, it's a theme with our conversation, this idea of rhythm and release and how certain films kind of transcend just their narrative, that you can have the same experience every time you see it. And for me, that's Karate Kid. You know, that final moment in Karate Kid when Daniel LaRusso's, you know, knee is hurt and the music is building, and you've got Johnny there with a crease behind him, and I think, you know, the other Cobra Kai yelling, and you see the fear in Ralph Macchio's face, and then the music is building, and it again. To your point about setups and payoffs, right? You know, he raises his leg and it's such a great visual payoff for the setup we've had. And it's a fantastic moment of filmmaking because there's no cuts and you know there's no visual effects. So I don't know how many takes they did or how they got this so right, but it's one shot. It's that proscenium angle. And the ref blows the whistle and William Zabka runs in. And Ralph Macchio does the kick. And I mean, it looks like his foot hits his face. And yep. Zabka like sort of throws his weight backwards. and And you see all the extras erupt. No cuts. And the music does its release. And it's just, you can't help but be on cloud nine when you watch that. I'll watch that sequence over and over and over again and have the same feeling every single time.
It ties into a little bit like the Captain America Endgame moment you were talking about earlier. It's such a good moment in movies where your hero is beaten down, looks like it's all over, and then just pulls that thing out of the bag, whether it's in their control or not in their control, but something happens and you're like, oh, it's game on again.
And perfectly executed. Because it's one thing to write that in a script and plan it. I've certainly done it every project I've worked on. That's what you're always trying to achieve. But it could not have been executed better, from the music to the photography to the performance and the discipline to not cut. I mean, I'm not a big believer in the extended take. I think that's a lot of directors just kind of who are bored with their story and trying to show off. But when you find those moments where it elevates your film by not cutting, you have to embrace those and you have to have the discipline not to cut. And as a filmmaker, it's really hard because you're always trying to change things. You're always trying to make things better, make the scene better, find the best performance from every take, make sure the audience is exactly where you want them to be in that moment. And so your instinct is to cut. And the fact that they didn't in that moment is just it made it so much more powerful.
A wonderful moment. Right, we're playing the climax to Karate Kid as the moving moment that makes you literally or metaphorically pump your fist in the air. Next. Right. Jeff, we're going to play on the big screen what you consider cinema's most shocking moment.
Oof, most shocking moment. That's tough because I love being surprised and shocked in a movie theater. I remember it like it was yesterday when I saw Seven in the movie theater and Gwyneth Paltrow's head was in the box. And I was completely floored in that moment, but that's not my choice. Another strong contender would be Alien 3. We've talked a little bit about Aliens. Aliens was such a beloved movie of mine. I wore out the VHS tape that I owned that had the film. And so I was very excited to see Alien 3. So when, again, spoiler alert, Ripley dies in that, I was kind of just like totally flummoxed and downtrodden and despairing. Shocked. I couldn't believe they did that.
To park Ripley's death for a moment, how did you feel loving Aliens as much as I did when you sat down to Alien 3 and in the first 5 minutes, Hicks and Newt are dead? I was like, for me, you say you were downtrodden when Ripley died. I spent that movie being downtrodden because as a kid, you were like, well, Hicks is cool, man. I loved Hicks.
Yeah, obviously David Fincher is a genius. Seven is one of my favorite films of all time. Also, as a filmmaker, I understand the impulse to want to do your own thing. And especially if you're working in a franchise, how do you do your own thing while also honoring the story that's come before? So I certainly can imagine his thought process. But like you, I was not a fan of the choice. I felt like it totally undercut the film. It just didn't work for me at all. There was a Dark Horse comic. I think it's called Newt's Chronicle or Newt's Story. And it basically posited that Alien 3 was a dream. And that's how they kind of carried the story forward from Aliens in the comics. And I thought that was kind of a fun, cheeky sort of way to get around it and keep the story going for fans like you and me. So I was not happy about that is my short answer. My final answer to your question.
Yeah.
Would be The Crying Game when that famous shot happens when you tilt down. I mean, it was at a different time in our culture. Obviously, there wasn't such awareness of people who are trans as there is now. So for me, as I think I was maybe in 10th or 11th grade when I saw it. I was on a college trip looking at schools in California with my mom. And we went and saw this movie that we heard was supposed to be really brilliant. She took me to a lot of art house films and independent films. So I didn't only see, Batman and Star Wars. And we went and saw that film. And I was shocked, beyond shocked. In fact, I remember walking out of there with my mother being like, I don't know how we really talk about this. But we did. And I remember over lunch saying, I almost wanted to see the movie again, but not watch the screen and just turn around and look at the audience when that moment happened to see their faces, to see how they processed it.
That's a great shout. Yes. Yeah. And I think, I mean, when you watch it again now and the line, you did know, didn't you? And it's like, it's such a good line. Yeah. Great choice. I don't want you to spoil any elements of Imaginary, but do you have a favorite shock? Is there a way of describing your favorite shocking moment from Imaginary without giving too much away? Because obviously, you know, you don't want to kill your favorite shock in the movie.
I don't think I can without giving it away. What I would say is just remember, it is a movie about imagination. And it would be a disservice to the conceit of the film if it was just a killer teddy bear movie.
You're saying that, and I can't help but look at Chauncey again, still staring back at me with those petrifying eyes. I love it. Right then, let's play now some audio through the speakers in the room, and it is the line or piece of dialogue from a movie that most affected you.
Well, there's so many great lines in cinema. It's almost impossible to have this conversation. We could talk for hours. But what I took from your question is that most affected you. So it's not just that I'm acknowledging a great piece of writing or a great performance, but I'm saying, how did it land for me? How did it affect me? And if I had to pick a line of dialogue that affected me the most profoundly, it would probably be Carol Ann and Poltergeist saying, "They're here." It was, that movie really changed me fundamentally. As a person, I saw it, you know, as I'm trying, what year did it come out? 83?
82. I think it was, 83. Yeah.
So I saw in the movie theater, 82, I would have been 6 years old, 7 years old. I do think it was borderline irresponsible of my parents to take me to see that movie. I think at the time, you know, the PG-13 rating didn't really exist. Steven Spielberg was a producer. They thought, you know, oh, it's going to be another E.T. But that movie messed me up bad. I had really terrible nightmares for years afterwards. I would say almost all of the kind of dark thoughts I have, the part of my brain that allows me to tell scary movies, it was activated by that film. So 100% Carol Ann, they're here.
It's so weird you say that. It's the only movie as a kid, and I loved horror as a kid. I was all into horror. It's the only film I ever turned off, and I turned it off at that scene. And it's because I loved TV so much that I couldn't have a TV be scary. I didn't want to be robbed of the TV in my life.
I mean, that movie was so ahead of its time. This idea that a house could be haunted and it didn't have to look like a haunted house. I mean, I'm sure there's films that did it before. I mean, there are no new ideas, honestly. But as far as entering the public consciousness and telling a story about a haunted house that didn't look like a haunted house, for me, that was the first film that did it. And it reinvented the sort of the supernatural horror genre. I mean, Paranormal Activity doesn't exist without Poltergeist, and certainly Imaginary doesn't exist without Poltergeist.
We hear Carol Ann saying, "They're here," through the Dolby Atmos speakers. And it's our penultimate question before we get to the movie you are screening for us tonight. And this is what you consider, Jeff, the best use of music in a movie.
Best. Again, that's so hard. I mean, the most iconic, and it's so iconic it's cliche, is certainly Jaws. I mean, the music in that movie becomes a character in the film. It's the voice of the shark. And with just two notes, dunna, you have a feeling in your gut that's so overwhelming. I'd have to say, if we're just looking at all of cinema history, I would have to probably say Jaws. But another one I would like to point out that's more recent, that I thought was really just amazing, was the use of music in Creed. You know, that I thought what Ryan Coogler did with that film and the discipline he showed and how he used the music from the Rocky franchise was really effective. I don't know if you remember, but you don't hear anything other than really the Adrian theme from the earlier movies for most of the film until the third act. They never do the Rocky classic fanfare in any of the training sequences, any of the earlier fights. You never hear it. You only hear it in that final fight when when Michael B. Jordan is on the ropes, it feels like he's going to lose. And Sylvester Stallone's got him in the corner. And I don't remember the exact line of dialogue, but some version of like, you're not a mistake. You hear me? You are not a mistake. Right. And then the bell rings and Adonis Creed gets off that bench and he goes out to the ring and you hear the da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. And you're just, and I mean, again, my chest just swelled. I think I probably got a little choked up and he starts throwing punches as that music is blasting. And the fact that they had the discipline to hold it back until that final fight, I thought it was just such an incredible use of music in movies.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Holy shit. I was choking up. It's brilliant because I think Sylvester Stallone's line, I don't remember it either, but it was something like, you know, go fuck this guy up. Just go, you can do it. Go fucking get him. And you're just like, yes! What a great choice. Well, we hear the Rocky theme dying down in the speakers because we have arrived. Jeff, it is time to announce to your mum and this packed auditorium at 7 p.m. this evening exactly what movie out of all other films you have picked for us to watch. What are we watching, Jeff?
Well, we've talked about so many great films, and it's tempting to pick one of the films we've already talked about, like Karate Kid or Aliens. But I think I'm gonna pick one that I haven't talked about yet. I get asked all the time, what's my favorite movie? And it's such a ridiculous question to ask a filmmaker. It's like, you know, asking a chef, what's your favorite single meal? Like, I mean, your brain doesn't work that way. But I certainly have a list of movies I love, and it's always changing and evolving. Like, you know, new movies will enter the list, old movies will drop off, old movies will re-enter the list. But one movie that is always on my list, always on my top 10 list, I don't think I've ever given a list without this film, is Back to the Future. I think Back to the Future is a perfect movie to see in a theater with a packed audience. It's thrilling, it's emotional, it's fun, it's funny, it's both grounded in a reality that you accept. Like, you never feel like it's a skit or the actors are like, you know, playing make-believe. But at the same time, there is an acknowledgement of how absurd the scenario is that allows the audience to kind of be in on the joke with the filmmakers, but then also have an authentic emotional experience. Like, how can you not feel real emotion when George McFly finally punches Biff? You know, how can you not be worried about Marty McFly getting back to his family? So the feelings are real. They're strong. The setup and payoffs in that film should be studied. I mean, there's not a wasted moment in the first 30 minutes of that movie. Every little line, every little piece of art direction, it's setting up something you're going to see later on. So you can watch it over and over again and enjoy it more and more as you pick up that stuff. And also, honestly, I love some of the stories about how that movie was made, that, you know, it wasn't supposed to be a DeLorean. It was supposed to be like a refrigerator or something like that. And they changed it to a car at the last minute. And it wasn't supposed to be a lightning storm. It was supposed to be something that happens out at Los Alamos with a nuke, but they weren't allowed to leave the lot. So they had to come up with a finale that took place on the Universal lot. So it was, so much of it was just by accident. And it illustrates something that you talked about when we first started speaking, which is, I love filmmaking because it's collaborative art, because it's not just all these people and artists coming together. It's the circumstance. It's the moment in time. It's where we are in our culture. It's production constraints. It's budget issues. It all just comes together to create this crazy alchemy that you can never recreate, no matter how hard you try. And you get this thing that exists forever. It never goes away. That movie you make will exist forever. But that moment that you made it in is gone. And you can never recreate it, no matter how hard people have tried with sequels and reboots and reinventions. That moment was so unique and so distinct and so determined by the people, the place, the time that you were in, that sometimes you can make something that will last forever. And I think that's what they did with Back to the Future. That movie will last forever in our hearts and minds. And it's just such a pleasure to watch it with a group.
It is a wonderful movie. You did mention reboots there. It does get talked about every so often. The idea that maybe You know, Back to the Future could have a reboot. People talk about it. These are conversations that we both know are happening. What are your thoughts on that? And I guess reboots in general as a thing.
There's a question coming up about something about my career that's a surprise. Yeah. I will tell you, this wasn't the answer I thought about, but I will tell you something that nobody knows, which is I love that movie so much that a few years ago, I had a little heat in the TV space. I'd sold a bunch of pilots. And I said to my TV agent, I said, can you get me a meeting at Image Movers? I have an idea for a Back to the Future TV show. No, I've never talked about this publicly before. And so he called up, I think it's Jack Rapke, who is Zemeckis' producing partner, and their TV executive. And they said, listen, we'd love to meet with Jeff. We really want to be in the TV space in a big way. But if he wants to talk about Back to the Future, we shouldn't take the meeting. Bob doesn't want to do anything with Back to the Future. Don't bother. So my agent called me and was like, well, they said, don't bother if it's about Back to the Future. And I said, lie to them. Tell them it's not about Back to the Future. Just get me in the room. So they get me in the room and I'm sitting there with, you know, Zemeckis' producing partner and the TV staff. And they said, we hear you have something you want to pitch us. And I said, I know you told my reps I couldn't pitch anything about Back to the Future. I told them to lie to you. That's exactly what I'm here to do. We're already in the room. Can I please just pitch you my idea? And so I love the brand so much, the story, the characters. I too want to see the story continue, but I don't want it to be in a way that is a disservice to the original one. I don't want a reboot. I don't want a reimagining. But how do you continue that story? And I had this idea. And this was when TV was just exploding and everybody, you know, wanted TV for all these streaming services. It was the height of peak TV development. I said, we could do a sort of a 10 or 12 episode series, and we could do multiple seasons, but I would keep it to 10 or 12 per season. And I would start with Doc Brown as a young man working on the Manhattan Project, because there's allusions to that in the film. And the DeLorean from the future shows up. And in the DeLorean is Marty McFly's great-granddaughter. And she says, you know, the world has ended. And we know why. And we need you to come with me to help stop the end of the world. And basically, it's almost like a sort of a Quantum Leap kind of pitch where, as any fan of film and science fiction knows, the one thing you can't do in time travel is change the future, right? That's the one thing you're not supposed to do. Well, guess what? In Back to the Future, they did it. They broke the cardinal rule, right? At the 1957, 1954, I can't remember the exact year, whatever that year in the 50s was, when I think it was like Romance Under the Sea, whatever that dance was, when Marty McFly was there and he got George McFly to punch Biff, they changed the future. So the end of the world has happened and they've been able to map it all the way back to that dance. So everyone who was at that dance, their lives changed and their destinies were changed. So now on this TV show, a young Doc Brown and Marty McFly's great-granddaughter, they now have to go and they need to find those people and their descendants and help them get back on the track they were supposed to be on to avert this reality-ending catastrophe that's coming, right? They need to restore the timeline. So it's very like sort of TVA before the TVA even was a thing with Marvel. And it's their job. So each episode would be about either finding someone who was at the dance or a descendant of someone who was at the dance and helping them get back on track, helping them realize the destiny they were supposed to have in the hope that they would restore the timeline.
Wow. That's a hell of a pitch, man.
And so what happened was I gave the pitch and they said, and Jack said, I think it was Jack Rapke. He said, I really meant it when I said we didn't want to do anything about Back to the Future, but that is a fun pitch and you pitch it well. He said, I'll tell you what I'll do. If you want to write a letter to Robert Zemeckis and pitch the show in the letter, I will make sure he gets it, but that's all I can do for you. And I said, great. So I wrote the letter. They sent it to Robert Zemeckis and the response was, They love my passion for the property. So grateful that I took the time. But Bob Zemeckis was adamant that he did not want to do anything with Back to the Future.
Man, I mean, yeah, that's fine. I do kind of feel like that, you know, of all the possible pitches that could have ever been presented as a way of doing Back to the Future, like justice, I'm sold, man. Oh, that's an incredible pitch, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, my gosh, Hollywood is littered with pitches and movies that never happen. I have so many scripts I've written. I mean, like I said, that X-Force script, I think, is probably one of my favorite scripts, and that will never get made. So I think it's a badge of honor to have an idea that you love, that you know would have worked, but never was realized, because it's just a reminder that that storytelling and working in Hollywood, it's just a game of averages, right? You just got to keep swinging that bat. You got to keep trying. Hopefully you connect. Hopefully you knock something out of the park. And if you have these ideas that could have worked, that could have been home runs, then you're on the right track.
I hear you. I just think, you know, I'm not going to go on about it because it's not happening. And obviously, you know, that's the past. But genuinely, that just it feels like it would have been very, very ahead of its time as well. I think that's the thing as well. It would have predated a lot of things that also then, you know, have played in that sandbox. So
yeah,
as a cool pitch. A cool pitch.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Hey, the curtains have closed on Back to the Future. The guests are milling out, smiling, chatting, and thanking you for taking them on this incredible night out of the movies. But before you go, and I, you know, that was a hell of, we've almost answered this question, but it is time to tell us an exclusive piece of information about your career, past, present, or future.
Well, that was about the past, so I guess I would probably choose to focus on the future. I guess, you know, I would probably talk about, you know, the next project that I'm really excited about. I mean, I get sent opportunities to either rewrite or direct movies that studios already want to make, and that's certainly been the path of my career in recent years. But I'm also always trying to think about movies that I just want to make and want to see as a fan. And I also always want to stretch and grow. You know, I've worked in so many different genres, from horror to action to comedy. And you understand better than most the importance of music in movies. And so I really want to make a movie about music. And I got sent this book called Van Halen Rising by Greg Renoff that chronicles the story of the band Van Halen, basically before they got their record deal. So it doesn't tell the story of what happened when they got their record deal and the rise of their popularity and their eventual fall and all the shenanigans with David Lee Roth and Sammy Hagar. It's just a story of the Van Halen brothers in Southern California in the late 60s, 70s. They moved here. They were immigrants. They didn't speak English. Most people don't know this. And they were incredibly poor, but they were musical prodigies. And they started playing backyard parties. They basically invented the backyard kegger. And then across town, there was this rich kid with, you know, huge rock star ambitions and no discernible musical talent named David Lee Roth. And he decided, you know, that he wanted to be in their band. But he auditioned for their band and they said no. They're like, you're fucking terrible. We don't want you in our band. So he started his own band. So through high school, you had these two bands that hated each other. You had the Van Halen band and you had the David Lee Roth band. And they kind of invented the battle of the bands and the backyard kegger. And it was this crazy time. Neither band could forget a record deal. They couldn't get a club gig. So only when they got over their differences, only when they buried the hatchet and realized that they needed each other, were they able to come together and create a band that got the attention of, wait for it, not a record label, but Gene Simmons. And this is totally true. Gene Simmons, the biggest rock star in the world at the time, actually wanted to sign this band, not because he wanted to get them a record deal or he believed in them, because he wanted to break them up. Because he wanted the Van Halen brothers to be in his solo act. And so you have this wonderful story of it's an immigrant story, but it's also a story about people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, people with different musical styles, learning to compromise, learning to overcome their differences. And only when they do that, do they encounter, you know, this third act antagonist that symbolizes everything they want, who is there to destroy them. And just by overcoming that final challenge, did they actually come together as a band and find themselves in a place where they were ready to record an album and become this huge sensation. And my movie ends on the first day they go into the recording studio.
That's awesome. How far along are you with this?
Script is done. It's going to go out as a spec probably in the next month or so. Nobody really knows anything about it. Nobody's read it yet. Just my reps and the producers and obviously Greg, the author of the book. And I, you know, It's very difficult getting movies made. It's even harder when you have a massive music budget in the movie. So it's going to be a hard one to get off the ground. Maybe we won't. But I really love the story, and I really hope I get to make it, and so that people can see it on the big screen in the theater together.
And obviously, and I guess, you know, this happens in pitch meetings a lot. You know, everyone wants a shorthand for what a movie's like. It's a bit of this with a little soupçon of this. It's a bit of this with a bit of this. Do you have reference points, like tonally, where you see it sitting?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I would say it's sort of tonally in the same space as like a Dazed and Confused or an Almost Famous. I think it has a lot of the fun of like a Shakespeare in Love, sort of seeing these iconic personalities in their nascent sort of forms, not yet ready to emerge into what they eventually will become. So I'd say sort of Dazed and Confused with a little bit of Almost Famous.
It sounds wonderful. Best of luck with pitching that, Jeff, because I certainly, as a DJ who used to play some Van Halen, I know you used to DJ as well when you were younger. There's that brief moment where you put on, you know, I know it was their latest stuff, but you put on Van Halen's Jump. And like when people, it's one of those tunes that people put their hands in the air. They're like, yes, it's the closest. There's a moment where you think, it's like I wrote it. That split second where you forget that you had nothing to do with it. You're like, I just made people put their hands in the air.
Well, that ties back into what we were talking about with music and that fist pump moment from Karate Kid. Actually, what I've written in the script, the final moment before we do that little epilogue where they go into the recording studio, but the climax of the movie is this final show they did after they rebuked Gene and they realized that they had one last chance to get a record deal or they're going to have to take normal jobs and kind of give up their rock star dreams. They did this show at the Pasadena Civic Center. And I try to structure it almost like the end of Karate Kid or any great movie where everything comes together. And it's like the first time where they really harmonize, when Eddie does the finger tapping on the fretboard and Dave finally does like this huge aerial jump and does the splits in the air. You just feel it like all come together in this moment. And I say we slow it down into sort of epic slow motion. And off of that, we cut to them pulling up to the record studio and I actually play Jump, like the opening keyboard chords off that moment, because you do have that overwhelming feeling of like wanting to pump your fist in the air.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, Jeff, I'm excited for you. That sounds like a great project. And that is it. Your taxi has arrived to ferry you back to reality. All that remains to do is to recap your perfect trip to the movies. You are going with your mum at 7 in the evening. You are sitting in the dead center of the cinema and you are having some popcorn with butter. Your fondest movie memory. You're putting up a poster for going to see Titanic on the opening day and being blown away. Your worst movie memory was the burning reel of Batman in 1989. The last performance that brought you to tears is the epic portal scene from the end of Endgame on your left. And your unpopular movie opinion is that Rocky IV may well be the best Rocky movie. We're playing a trailer for the movie you're most looking forward to seeing at the cinema, which is, of course, Deadpool 3. The moment that makes you pump your fist in the air is the final climactic single shot sequence of Karate Kid. Cinema's most shocking moment. We had a little bit of Ripley dying in Alien 3, but no, we have gone for that scene in The Crying Game. You did know, didn't you? And the line of dialogue that most affected you is, "They're here," from Poltergeist, which, in your own words, changed your life forever. The best use of music in a movie is, well, it's Jaws. Fundamentally, but we're also going to play the use of the Rocky theme in Creed in the final fight. And we finally get to watch Back to the Future in this cinema. What a wonderful trip to the movies. Jeff, all that leaves me to do is to ask, have you had a good time?
Alex, it's been such a pleasure. I love movies. I love talking about movies with people who love them as much as I do. And it's so clear that you do. This is really a wonderful thing that you put together, and I'm so grateful that you had me on as a guest.
Oh, that's so nice to hear, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking film with you, and I cannot wait to see Imaginary opening in the UK on March the 8th. Jeff, have a great rest of your day. Thank you so much.
You too. Take care.
And as Jeff's cab carries him out of this dimension, away from our virtual cinema, back to reality, we must all leave his movie paradise as well. But before I say my final farewell for this episode, don't forget you can find the full video for today's Jeff Wadlow interview, and indeed for every guest, over on our Trip to the Movies YouTube channel. So if you'd like to watch that, do head over there. And as I said, if you like what you see, do please hit subscribe and help us grow the podcast. And that really is it. I'll be back next week when another guest fills our cinema with their celluloid dreams as they take us on a trip to the movies. Bye-bye.